Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. South Sudan's government said it will present to its national legislature on Tuesday the peace agreement that was signed last month between the government and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar to end nearly 2 years of conflict. The country's information minister said after receiving the document, the legislature will set up committees to study and propose a final resolution on the adoption of the agreement. The rebels have already said they are likely to ratify the agreement Tuesday. At least 12 police officers have been killed in eastern Turkey. Dorian Jones has details in this report from Istanbul.
State media reports say the officers were killed when a roadside bomb hit the minibus carrying them to their morning shift at a border post in eastern Turkey. The suspected PKK attack comes as some 40 Turkish jets pounded Kurdish rebel bases for a second night, both in Turkey and neighbouring northern Iraq. The airstrikes were in retaliation for Sunday's PKK attack that killed 16 Turkish soldiers. On Monday, Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu promised not to let up in the battle against the Kurdish rebels, who've been fighting for autonomy in southeastern Turkey.
O dağlar o teröristlerden temizlenecek. Ne olursa olsun temizlenecek.
The Prime Minister said, whatever happens, these terrorists must be wiped out from the mountains. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Congressional review of the international agreement on Iran's nuclear program enters its final stretch Tuesday as U.S. lawmakers return from a month-long recess. Congress has until September 17th to review the terms and vote for or against. And while the outcome appears increasingly certain, there is intrigue on how the process will play out. VOA News. Iran's president says his country is ready to hold talks with the United States and Saudi Arabia on ways to resolve the Syrian civil war, providing that those negotiations can secure peace and democracy in Syria. Iran is a leading patron of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and accuses Sunni rival Saudi Arabia and the U.S. of siding with anti-Assad rebels and militants. Britain's defense minister said Tuesday the military would consider more airstrikes against militants in Syria if they meant stopping likely terror attacks against British interests. Michael Fallon made the comment to BBC Radio a day after Prime Minister David Cameron revealed that Britain's Royal Air Force killed three Islamic State militants, including two Britons, in an August 21st drone strike. A senior United Nations official is calling for a strong response by the international community to the refugee crisis in Europe. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey are sheltering more than 4 million Syrian refugees. European frontline states, in particular Italy and Greece, are shouldering the greatest burden arising from the influx of refugees from countries in the Middle East and elsewhere. This is not fair, says Peter Sutherland, the UN official in charge of migration. He says caring for refugees is not just the responsibility of the states bordering a conflict zone or the first countries of asylum where they arrive, but a global responsibility.
We have to find a method to get specific commitments from every state to taking refugees and financially contributing.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi is calling for vigorous international monitoring of her country's November general elections. It will be the first since decades of military rule ended there in 2011. She posted a video Tuesday on the Facebook page of her National League for Democracy.
The general elections that will be taking place on the 8th of November in Burma will be a crucial turning point for our country. For the first time in decades, our people will have a real chance of bringing about real change. This is a chance that we cannot afford to let slip.
Tuesday marks the official start of the campaign period for the November 8th vote, which will seat a parliament that will then select a president. North and South Korea have agreed to resume the reunion of families separated for more than 60 years by the Korean War. South Korea's unification ministry said Tuesday the reunions will be held from October 20th through the 26th, and North Korean state media confirmed the agreement. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
A senior United Nations official is calling for a strong response by the international community to the refugee crisis in Europe. The official says the tens of thousands of Syrian refugees arriving in Europe are a global responsibility, and all nations must do their part to protect those fleeing war and persecution.
That's VOA reporter Lisa Schlein. We'll have details next. Also in the news, an appeals court in The Hague, Netherlands, has rejected a request for temporary release from detention by former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo. And Cameroon cracks down on ghost workers who receive salaries but are not employed by the government. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Angola, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the International Organization for Migration, IOM, has officially opened its new Global Migration Data Analysis Center in Berlin, Germany. It will provide authoritative analysis of data on global migration issues while advocating for the better collection and use of migration data. Germany is the third largest migrant hosting country in the world. The country expects to receive up to 800,000 asylum applications this year. The head of the center, Dr. Frank Lasko, spoke with me about some of the goals of the center.
We will be trying to promote a better understanding of global migration trends at a time when migration has become one of the top policy issues for decision makers around the world, and particularly here in Europe. And in recent years, IOM has been constantly inundated with requests for data and information and statistics about migration. And the creation of this new center will give us a greater capacity to provide information to the media, government, civil society about the key migration trends and key migration policy issues occurring around the world.
What types of migration trends will you all be analyzing?
Currently, the greatest demand, at least from the media here in Europe, has been for information on the number of arrivals in European countries, the number of migrant fatalities, number of people are missing, but also a better understanding of the drivers of migration, the profile of migrants coming to Europe. But our center will not focus solely on the European region. We will be producing a number of global reports. One report will look at how the world views migration. It will be a report about public opinion and public attitudes to migration. We'll also be looking at how different countries in the world collect data about human smuggling. And we'll have a flagship report, which we'll publish on International Migrants Day, looking at global migration trends, recent, present, and future.
Will the data differentiate between migrants and refugees?
Well, according to the UN definition of migration, refugees are one subgroup within the statistics on migration collected by the UN, the UN's population division based in New York. Of course, we will collect data on both forced migration and voluntary migration. Much of the work that IOM does around the world is in humanitarian situations where we are providing direct assistance to displaced populations, either people who are displaced within countries, but also those who are displaced across borders.
I understand also that the information will help to dispel some of the myths surrounding migrants.
One of the problems with data today is not simply that often there is a lack of data, but the data that does exist is not always shared very effectively, and the data that appears in the media doesn't always reach the general public. So there are many misperceptions, for example, the scale of migration. In a number of surveys in European countries, the general public often thinks that there are three times as many migrants as there really are. So one of our challenges will be to work with the media to communicate better about migration and migration data.
Germany is the third largest migrant hosting country in the world.
Yeah.
As you all have pointed out, they're expecting to receive up to 800,000 asylum applications this year. What is it with Germany that so many people want to be there?
It's not just a question of refugees and asylum seekers wanting to come to Germany. Germany is the main destination country for labor migrants in Europe. You have an increasing number of people coming from Spain, Greece, and Italy to work in Germany because there are jobs. And so the fact that people want to come to Germany is in many ways a healthy sign that the economy is strong and that there are opportunities here for many people to work.
That was Dr. Frank Lasko, head of IOM's new Global Migration Data Analysis Center. He spoke with me from Berlin, Germany. While the UN Refugee Agency says conditions are worsening for thousands of displaced Syrians and for more than 4 million Syrian refugees in neighboring countries, their deteriorating conditions in the Middle East may lead to even greater pressure as the EU struggles to manage critical migrant flows. Syrian refugees are the majority of those currently seeking asylum in Europe. UN spokesperson Melissa Fleming says funds for Middle East refugee programs are extremely limited. She says only 37% of their refugee and resilience program is funded for this year, and the World Food Program has cut 229,000 refugees in Jordan from food assistance. European reaction to current flows is mixed. The Greek Navy rescued 500 refugees whose 11 vessels floundered in the Aegean. More than 2,500 more are sailing to Athens from the Greek island of Lesbos, where another 15,000 remain stranded. Hungary continues construction of a 174-meter-long fence along the Serbian border. The prime minister dismissed his defense minister for moving too slowly on fence construction. Germany expects to welcome more than 800,000 and possibly more by the end of the year, but Poland says they will only take 2,000. Sweden received 700 asylum seekers in the past week and arrested 14 people as suspected smugglers. Meanwhile, lower numbers are still trying to cross the Mediterranean. The International Office for Migration says in the last 4 days, 2,300 migrants landed at 6 ports on the Italian coast. The Italian Navy has recovered 188 bodies from a fishing boat that sank off the Libyan coast. They are part of more than 2,700 migrants who have died seeking European asylum this year. A senior United Nations official is calling for a strong response by the international community to the refugee crisis in Europe. The official says the tens of thousands of Syrian refugees arriving in Europe are a global responsibility, and all nations must do their part to protect those fleeing war and persecution. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey are sheltering more than 4 million Syrian refugees. European frontline states, in particular Italy and Greece, are shouldering the greatest burden arising from the influx of refugees from countries in the Middle East and elsewhere. This is not fair, says Peter Sutherland, the UN official in charge of migration. He says caring for refugees is not just the responsibility of the states bordering a conflict zone or the first countries of asylum where they arrive, but a global responsibility. He notes there has to be a similar international response to the current crisis as happened during the time of the 1956 Hungarian Revolution and the crisis of the Vietnamese boat people at the end of the 1970s. On both occasions, he says, there was a global acceptance of responsibility.
We have to find a method, perhaps as we did in 1956 in the conference that took place then, to get specific commitments from every state in regard to taking refugees and financially contributing to dealing with the crisis which we now face.
Sutherland says he is disheartened that many European countries are blocking efforts to reach a unified effort to distribute refugees fairly among all 28 EU nations. He says the irony of Hungary's opposition to such a deal is not lost on him. Sutherland says all countries have an obligation to take a fair share of refugees. He says that includes the United States, Canada, Australia, those in Latin America, the Far East, and the Gulf Arab states, which he notes have taken in no refugees. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up on 16 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Well, violence continues in Burundi's capital as the spokesman for an opposition party was shot and killed late Monday night. Patrice Gahongo died when unknown gunmen assassinated him in front of his home while he was returning from work. Gahongo is the second member of the Union for Peace and Development, Zigambagana, killed by gunmen during the 3 months of opposition to the re-election of President Pierre Nkurunziza. The small opposition party's president, Zedi Feruzi, was killed in May. The capital has been rocked for several months by clashes between police, protesters, and members of the youth wing of Mr. Nkurunziza's ruling party. The president won a third term in July with little opposition. Thousands have fled the country and more than 100 have died in street clashes since the two-term president announced he would run for a controversial third term. Well, high-tech methods could soon be used to stop illegal logging. Delegates at the 14th World Forestry Congress in Durban, South Africa, heard about the proposed use of DNA, drones, and satellites to protect the timber resources. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Bank estimates illegal logging costs the global market $10 billion annually. The World Wildlife Fund says 70% of harvested timber in Gabon is considered illegal, as is 25% of Russia's timber exports and up to 60% of Indonesia's timber production. The American Forest and Paper Association estimates illegal logging costs U.S. firms alone $1 billion a year in the form of depressed prices and lost export opportunities. But that could change, thanks to huge advances in technology since the last World Forestry Congress 6 years ago. Charles Barber is director of the Forest Legality Alliance and Government Relations for the World Resources Institute Forests Program. He gives one example of how illegal logging can be hidden.
There's actually timber which is cut illegally and papers are falsified, and the illegality may happen in a lot of different ways. It could be a concession holder who actually has a legal right to cut some wood but is cutting a lot more than they should, or species that they shouldn't. Paperwork is being falsified, so it's actually leaving the country, going through international trade under the aegis of being part of legal trade. It's being laundered. It happens a lot.
He says illegal logging can also occur when forest areas are cleared for agriculture or palm oil production.
People have a clearing permit, but the actual land use conversion license which was given through corruption against the applicable rules. And then there's the hardcore smuggling, people going into national parks and cutting really precious woods like mahogany, rosewood, and it actually being smuggled into another country, like people smuggle illegal drugs. So when we say illegal logging, we're talking about a range of different things that violate different levels of law in different countries.
Barber, the former forest chief at the U.S. State Department, hosted an event at the Durban Summit called Genes, Drones, and Satellites.
If you have a particular piece of wood in front of you and your question is, what species is this and where did it come from? By extracting DNA from wood samples and comparing them to reference libraries, you can take that piece of wood and say, you know, this is rosewood and it came from Madagascar, or this is big leaf maple and it came from Washington State.
Barber says like fingerprints or facial recognition used to solve crimes, a reference library of wood DNA could be established. Drones and satellites could be used to help prevent illegal logging in the first place through real-time monitoring.
Drones have been used for patrolling, you know, more and more for illegal wildlife trafficking, and people are looking into use of those kinds of unmanned aerial vehicles for that. high-resolution remote sensing used to be incredibly expensive. It's getting cheaper. You have all these kinds of citizen science applications using Android phones, people on the ground taking pictures and uploading them just like they do at Instagram or something like this, but in an organized way to monitor what's going on the ground.
Barber says access to new technology has changed greatly. For example, he says the kind of remote sensing data on forests you can see now on your iPad or tablet was basically classified military intelligence 6 years ago. Nevertheless, Barber says new technology alone won't eliminate illegal logging. What's needed, he says, is a combination of technology, hard work, policy, and the political will to do something about the problem. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Reuters news agency reports that an appeals court in The Hague, Netherlands, has rejected a request for temporary release from detention by former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo. He faces trial on November 10th by the International Criminal Court on charges of 4 counts of crimes against humanity. Gbagbo was arrested in 2011 after the deaths of more than 3,000 people in post-election violence following his loss in a runoff election. His attorneys claim he suffers from post-traumatic stress syndrome and an unspecified physical ailment. The ICC also requested the government of Ivory Coast turn his wife Simone over to the court to face similar charges. Ivory Coast declined the request. Simone Gbagbo is serving a 20-year term in a prison in Ivory Coast. Cameroon says it does not recognize more than 10,000 people claiming salaries as state workers. Authorities published the names for a second time today as the country struggles to clean its payroll of ghost workers who cost the Central African nation an estimated $12 million every month. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Thousands of state workers from the hinterlands have been trooping to the capital, Yaoundé, to find out if their names are on the list of 10,000 suspected fake employees published this week. Teacher Emerence Ndum from northwestern Cameroon found his name on the list but says he is still working.
I just came to verify my own name, but I'm always in service. I just came because there are mistakes that they have done. Some people are here, their names are there, while they're always in service. It is list for those teachers, call them ghost teachers, who have not always been in service.
Government workers have 1 week to verify their service. The salaries of all those not identified will be suspended. Akko Chancel is a government official supervising the campaign to clean up the state payroll.
Somebody can be recruited, then at a given moment, he abandons his job. Maybe he has got a better job abroad, and maybe through relatives, he's continuing to take the salary. It can also be that some of them, maybe they are off late, but the salaries are continuing to pass. We need to know who has been taking that salary.
Chancel said 1 week is enough time for verification, because they do not want people who are overseas to have time to return and be identified with the complicity from corrupt government officials. Cameroon has 220,000 state workers, excluding the military and police. Officials say as many as 50,000 of them could be ghost workers. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A look at other developments. The New York Times, it says U.S. defense officials are drawing up plans to revise the training of moderate Syrian rebels to fight the Islamic State in Syria following significant shortcomings in training and tactics. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the assessment comes as Washington asks Greece to close its airspace to Russian supply flights to Syria amid concerns of a Russian military buildup in Syria.
The newspaper, citing four senior Defense Department and Obama administration officials, says the proposed changes follow a July 31st attack on 54 Syrian rebel graduates by members of the al-Nusra Front, the Syrian affiliate of al-Qaeda. According to classified assessments, the Syrian rebels were ill-prepared for the attack, were too few in number, lacked local support, and were deployed during the Eid holiday when many recruits took leave to visit their relatives. Among the options to improve results of the $500 million program include enlarging the force, shifting their deployments to ensure local support, and improving intelligence. The overt train and equip program is run by U.S. Special Forces with allied trainers in Turkey and Jordan. It is separate from a covert program run by the Central Intelligence Agency. Because of a stringent screening process, only dozens have been approved among thousands who have applied. After a year, supporters conceded the program is falling short of the 5,000 trained fighters originally envisioned. Former Ambassador James Jeffrey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, says the program is not serious enough to challenge the thousands of IS fighters, also known as ISIS, in Syria.
The military is containing ISIS, and they're doing a pretty good job of it, but this military effort will not destroy ISIS. We've been arming Syrians through a CIA campaign for years with the mission of going after Assad. Now it's a new mission, going after ISIS, but we never put any effort into it. That's why we wound up with 50 people. This is a $500 million program. It's supposed to generate 5,000 fighters.
At a Friday news briefing, U.S. Marine Corps Brigadier General Kevin Calais, the chief of staff of the Combined Joint Task Force Operation Inherent Resolve, told reporters the current classes and training are very promising.
The recruiting numbers for follow-on classes is very promising, and I think that says a lot to the program itself, in that as the numbers continue, this will be very additive to the anti-ISIL forces that are in northern Syria.
The New York Times says with the White House ruling out sending U.S. advisors into Syria with the trainees, the biggest challenge may be deciding where and how to send the rebels back in. Once again, Brigadier General Calais.
We don't have direct command and control with those forces once we do finish training and equipping them, when we put them back into the fight, if you will, with the vetted Syrian opposition and the moderate Syrian opposition forces that are in northern Syria fighting ISIL. That piece of it is a challenge, and if I had to point to a place where we could explore better lessons learned, that would be it.
According to the New York Times, one part of the program worked well, the ability to provide real-time air cover for rebels. It says Predator drones quickly rushed to help them once their base in northwest Syria came under attack from the al-Nusra Front fighters, killing dozens of the attackers. Meanwhile, there is growing U.S. concern over Russia's intentions in Syria. It has asked Greece to ban Russian supply flights using its airspace. The Greek Foreign Ministry says the request is being considered. Media reports indicate the Russian activity may be part of a plan to increase its support of the Assad government or as part of a plan to fight the IS militants. Last week, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the United States is aware of such reports of Russian military activity in Syria.
I will just say as a general matter that any military support to the Assad regime for any purpose, whether it's in the form of military personnel, aircraft, supplies, weapons, or funding, is both destabilizing and counterproductive. And the United States has worked to lead an international coalition of countries to take on ISIL. We certainly would welcome Russian support and contribution to that effort. And the United States has also been a leading advocate of trying to reach a diplomatic transition in the political leadership in Syria. And we certainly would welcome Russia's positive contribution to that diplomatic effort as well.
On Saturday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry expressed concern over reports of Russia's enhanced military buildup in Syria in a telephone call with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The New York Times has reported that Russia has sent a military advance team to Syria. It said the moves included the recent movement of prefabricated housing units for hundreds of people to a Syrian airfield and the delivery of a portable air traffic control station there. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Friday his country is providing serious training and logistical support to Syria's army. But the Russian leader said it was premature to discuss possible direct Russian involvement in military operations against the IS group in Syria. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
This is Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 1730 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A senior United Nations official calls for a strong response by the international community to the refugee crisis in Europe. Coming up, we'll have music from Angola. And in our feature segment, Nigeria's coffee sector is neglected for years in favor of more lucrative commodities like oil. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have kudos for a South African tennis player.
Kudos for a very tall South African tennis player, Kim. My opening serve is U.S. Open tennis, and here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the tall South African Kevin Anderson, who advanced to a Grand Slam quarterfinal for the first time in his career. The 29-year-old Anderson upset third-seeded Andy Murray of Britain in four sets in New York City. The final score, 7-6, 6-3, 6-7, and 7-6. Before leaving the court, Anderson had this to say to the fans in New York.
Yeah, I'm a little lost for words right now. You know, obviously coming out here playing Andy, it's a very tough matchup. And, you know, I just managed to keep my composure throughout and honestly played probably one of the best matches of my life. And obviously to get through to the quarterfinals for the first time here in New York feels very just amazing.
Kevin Anderson's amazing victory was definitely a career breakthrough. He had reached the fourth round of a Grand Slam event seven previous times, but was not able to advance to the quarterfinals. In the fourth set tiebreaker against Murray, Anderson won all 7 points.
You know, at that point, having lost that third set breaker in the fourth, I was just really focused just 1 point at a time. And obviously winning that first point on my serve and then going 2 love up and hitting a really good return winner to go 3 love up, I was like, let me just get at least one of these next serve points to get both of them. Now I'm suddenly 5 love up, was able to swing a little bit on that next point, grinded out a good point. I think always with breakers, it's really just about not getting too far ahead of yourself. And, I mean, not many times you're going to win at 7-0, so obviously switching ends at 6-0 is a lot more comfortable than being, you know, 5-all, 6-all, something like that.
At the post-match news conference, Kevin Anderson was asked what he thinks the reaction will be like in South Africa to his U.S. Open success.
It will be interesting to see. I mean, I think over the last couple of years, I feel like there's been quite a bit of press following my results on the tour. And, you know, I've always tried to, obviously there's been a lot of like Davis Cup questions regarding my participation. And, you know, I've just always tried to point out, I just feel like, you know, wins like this, at least when I was growing up, would have just meant a lot to see somebody in from South Africa, like, you know, I was looking at Wayne Ferreira and doing well on the tour itself. So, you know, I really hope, I know that the coverage has been great. So, you know, I'm pretty sure there'll be, you know, quite a bit of press back home. And, you know, that definitely feels good to see that obviously tennis is struggling a bit. So, you know, obviously the more the better.
In the quarterfinals, Kevin Anderson will play Stan Wawrinka of Switzerland, who won this year's French Open and last year's Australian Open. In the other quarterfinal matchups, top seed and world number one Novak Djokovic will meet Feliciano Lopez of Spain. Frenchman Joe Wilfried Tsonga will face defending champion Marin Cilic of Croatia. And another Frenchman, Richard Gasquet, will go against Swiss star Roger Federer. On the women's side in New York, the marquee matchup is later Tuesday night when Venus Williams, a two-time U.S. Open champion, takes on her younger sister, Serena, who is bidding for a fourth consecutive trophy in New York and a calendar year Grand Slam. In the other quarterfinal matchups, Kristina Mladenovic of France is facing Roberta Vinci of Italy. Petra Kvitova of the Czech Republic, a two-time Wimbledon champion, will play Flavia Panetta of Italy. and Victoria Azarenka of Belarus will meet Simona Halep of Romania. The tennis action is heating up in New York, and it wouldn't surprise me to see Jay-Z courtside.
Yeah, I'm out that Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my ties. Sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. I be spiked out, I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely from
Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
David, big weekend in African football. 25 qualifying matches played for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament, which will be hosted by Gabon. Let's go group by group and get your thoughts. In Group A, Togo travels to Djibouti and scores a 2-0 victory. And in the other group match, you kind of called this one, Liberia beats Tunisia 1-0 in Monrovia. Let's begin with the Liberians, David. You sort of hinted that they could pull off the upset.
Yes, Sonny. They're back home, thankfully, after the Ebola crisis, which prevented their national teams for some time from playing in Monrovia. And in Monrovia, Sonny, you can always say the Liberians have got a chance. They're a nation of fighters. They've overcome a lot of obstacles in various fields of life. The Tunisians, like all North African teams, are not particularly comfortable traveling south of the Sahara. I don't know, Sonny, is it a mental thing? But you'll notice quite often that a North African side that does very well against another country at home will struggle against the same country away. It was a tense time for the Liberians, though. It was 11 minutes from time when Doe scored the only goal. And that puts the Liberians right back in contention with 3 points after they lost 2-1 away to Togo in the first round. If that was a surprise, Sonny, the other match, very predictable, unfortunately, because Djibouti are among the weakest teams in the world. They are officially, according to the FIFA rankings, the weakest team in Africa. And almost a moral victory for them, in a way, restricting Togo to a 2-0 victory in Djibouti. Now, this was a Togolese team without Emmanuel Adebayor. He, of course, always has issues with the national team and specifically with the national coaches. He's up to his tricks again. He was very angry, apparently, when he was stripped of the captaincy after turning up for training very late before the Liberian match. And as a result of that, he boycotted the game in Djibouti. But nonetheless, Togo with 2 goals in the first half, 2-0 winners. The standing, Sonny, Togo on top with 6 points, Liberia and Tunisia with 3 each. Now, just a little area of confusion there from a lot of emails I get, including one today. They said, but Tunisia have got an 8-2 goal difference, in other words, +6. Liberia, on the other hand, have scored 2 and conceded 2, so they're 0 goal difference. And I was asked, why are Liberia on top of Tunisia? The reason is simple, Sonny. It's the head-to-head rule. So the fact that Liberia beat Tunisia puts them ahead of Tunisia. So you got Liberia second with 3 points, Tunisia third with 3 points, and Djibouti last with no points. In the next series of games, in mid-March 2016, Djibouti will host Liberia, and Tunisia will be at home to Togo.
Let's turn to Group B now, David. Madagascar playing at home, scoreless draw with Angola, and the Central African Republic defeats the visiting Democratic Republic of Congo 2-0. Your thoughts on Group B, David?
Well, Sonny, I decided I would watch the Madagascar-Angola game in Antananarivo, and I'm afraid when the final whistle blew, I wish I had not. Really boring game, but the main fault was the state of the pitch. And in fact, watching several games around Africa at the weekend, I was deeply depressed at the state of some pitches. The reason, unfortunately, is a lack of pitches in most African countries. So you get too many matches being played at the various available stadia, including the national stadium. And that was clearly the case in Madagascar. The ball was bobbling around all the time. Nice control was just about impossible. And that leads, Sonny, quite often to what I call Route 1 football, where the ball is just booted almost aimlessly down the field. And they hope that the opposing defense will make a mistake. And it certainly does not make for attractive football. Angola came closest with a disallowed goal midway through the first half. And in the second half, Madagascar stung the crossbar with a really powerful shot. But I guess 0-0 was probably a fair reflection of a game, Sonny. The highlights of which are not going to take up an awful lot of space in the African Cup of Nations qualifying DVD, that is for sure. If that match was reasonably predictable, the match in Bangui produced a shock. And it's great to see the Central African Republic back on winning ways. I slammed them in mid-year on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
When they lost 4-0 away to Angola, they were lackluster. And most important of all, they didn't seem to have any heart. They didn't have the ability to fight. But a very different occasion now. A new coach and two goals in the first half, one from the penalty spot, gave them an impressive 2-0 victory over their neighbors, the Democratic Republic of Congo, who have not started Group B particularly well. They scraped past Madagascar in Kinshasa by 2-1. And now they lose 2-0 away. And we remember, of course, that back in February, DR Congo finished third behind Ivory Coast and Ghana in the 2015 Cup of Nations. The standings, Angola are out in front with 4 points. Central African Republic and DR Congo have got 3 points each. And Madagascar, a little disappointingly, just 1 point. They did very well in the recent Southern African Championship for the CASAFA Cup in South Africa. And I believe myself and a lot of other people who saw them in action were hoping maybe for a little bit more from this Malagasy side. The next fixture, Sonny, DR Congo at home to Angola and Madagascar at home to the Central African Republic.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. And David will be back later this week with more soccer-licious commentary on the recent 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying matches played all across Africa. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, part two of our series on the chaos unfolding in South Africa's township. And next, Nigeria's coffee sector neglects 4 years in favor of more lucrative commodities like oil. Here's some music first. It's Danny L. from Angola with Amatumba.
Surra, cabelo postiço não lhe caiu, não sei pro que insiste. Estilo do bem marado, mas a teimosa resiste. Boca estilo surra, cara enfeitada tipo elele. Chega na disco, gingona, todos fogem da negra bué. Lá vem ela, Amatumba. Bunda vem a,
bunda tunda.
Corpo é corpo, esqueleto tipo em bondeiro. Desculpa menina, se ofendo, mas é demais.
faz não tem jeito. Dá-lhe, vai! Lá vem ela, a macumba. Bunda, venha, bunda, tunda. Corpo é corpo, é imbondeiro, é. Não aguento, não tem jeito. Olha só o espaço que ocupa no carro da outra. Tipo candongueiro bem cheio na hora da conta. Me racha um combo para abastecer na bomba. Que chega bem rápido para cair na quizamba. Agarra matumba,
chama a polícia.
Para matumba,
chama a polícia.
Acalma matumba, que era quizumba. Agarra matumba, agarra matumba,
chama a polícia.
Para matumba,
chama a polícia.
Acalma matumba, que era quizumba. Agarra matumba. Fé do Rio de Janeiro, mas mesmo assim não tem jeito. Lente, luta contra dente, que uso é de ferro. Galena, dá licença, tenta chegar no sapato. Pois mudou o pecado, aterrando um afro marado. Lá vem ela,
a malaca,
candongueira,
a chancheira.
Se te agarra, parte esqueleto. Desculpa, menina, se ofendo, mas o retrato é verdadeiro.
Ela te quer, o que ela quer? Ela te quer, vai fazer o quê? Eu não lhe quero, vai fazer o quê? Eu não lhe quero, é melhor lhe dar pra te ensinar. Agora ou nunca. É melhor lhe dar pra te ensinar. Agora ou nunca.
Não vale a pena de cas malaicas, de nainita. Se ela não lhe quero, se ela lhe quero, ele não quero.
Tu ama tu.
Não vale a pena vir ofender. Você só se coça com quem quero. Ela te quero, você não quer.
Tumba, matumba.
Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Comprou no estrangeiro, mas continua matumba.
Danny L with Amatumba. Well, tens of thousands of women in South Africa are raped each year. Women's rights groups say a woman is raped in South Africa every 26 seconds. The country's Medical Research Council says many victims don't bother to report they've been raped for fear of reprisal. Deep Sloot is one of South Africa's rape hotspots, a huge shackland north of Johannesburg and home to hundreds of thousands of people living in extreme poverty. Darren Taylor reports in part two of a series on the chaos unfolding in the township.
A man uses a rusted axe to hack chunks of meat from a cattle carcass infested with flies on a street corner in Deep Sloot. Chickens awaiting slaughter sit motionless in cages, eyes blinded by a bright sun. Across the road, the word sex is painted in purple capital letters on a crumbling wall. Not far from this is Deep Sloot's only safe house for abused women.
We can get up to 22 rapes and beatings of women dropping in there on a Friday evening. Maybe six on a good night.
Glennis van Holter volunteers at the Green Door Project. It's led by councillor Brown Lekakela. Almost every night, especially on weekends, women and girls who've been raped come to him for help.
They look terrible, stressed and hopeless, that there is nothing on earth it can help them. They will be smelling that person's sweat. They will be bleeding, scars all over the face. They will be dirty if maybe it happened on the street with mud everywhere, and it's terrible.
Local police say there are so many rapes in Deep Sloot that they investigate only a fraction. Most perpetrators remain on the loose, free to rape again and again. Lekakela says rape is a normal part of life in Deep Sloot, and most residents laugh it off as not a real crime. He cites unemployment as a big reason for the high incidence of rape. Von Halter says most families in Dipsluit have been abandoned by the men who should be decent role models for their children.
Where the hell are all the fathers who should be teaching their sons? But those same fathers are the rapists and the guys in jail. And so it's just being perpetuated generation after generation after generation because we're not dealing with the anger that young boys are feeling.
Von Holter says the young men are angry because when they leave school, they can't find jobs and feel worthless and lost. She maintains they then vent their fury on the only people they see as even more powerless and useless than themselves, women and children. A small, thin woman in her early 20s is curled up on a sofa in a living room in Dipsluit. Esther Masilo, not her real name, is listening to her favorite music and fingering her braided hair. She tells how her ex-boyfriend forced her into his shack at gunpoint after she'd visited a nearby tavern.
He told me, "You are going to undress now. I want to have sex with you, or else I will shoot you."
Marcelo says she undressed and begged the assailant to use a condom, to which he agreed. She says while he was raping her, she pretended to lose consciousness, hoping that this would put him off.
When he realized I was like a dead body, he removed the condom. Then he carried on raping me.
This 15-year-old schoolgirl says a man claiming to be a traditional healer recently arrived at her home in Dipsluit. He told her parents she'd been bewitched and that he needed to bathe her in a river to cleanse her of an evil spirit. Reluctantly, they agreed, and the man led her into the bush.
He told me to take my clothes off. I did, but I refused to remove my panties. Then he grabbed me roughly, pulled my panties off, and raped me.
Marcelo nods off to an insurance advert on TV. Like most rape survivors in Dipsluit, she says she hasn't heard from the police since the day she reported the crime against her, 6 months ago. Marcelo has now given up on ever getting justice and is just praying that the man who raped her doesn't track her down to kill her. To escape her pain and trauma, Marcelo acknowledges she's now drinking a lot and taking drugs.
The fear comes when I'm sober. When I'm drunk and high, I'm not afraid. When I feel fear, I smoke and drink and listen to loud music, and then the fear goes away. That's how I live now.
Lekekela enters another home and prepares to hear another tale of brutality against a woman. As he takes notes, he whispers, "I like helping women, but I wish I wake up one day and no one phones me for help." I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Dipsluit, South Africa.
Like many of its cash crops, Nigeria's coffee sector has been neglected for years in favor of more lucrative commodities like oil. But as Chris Stein reports from Lagos, one of the few commercial coffee roasters in the country plans to change that.
The coffee found on the streets and in the supermarkets of Nigeria is mostly of the instant sort and almost always imported. But Nasser Ali thinks Nigerians are ready for something different. A daughter of a Kenyan coffee family, she runs Kaldi Africa, which takes beans grown in eastern Taraba State and roasts them in a warehouse in the commercial capital Lagos to make perhaps Nigeria's only local blend. Ali is counting on the country's rising consumer class to shun imports in favor of her homegrown brew.
We are trying to see how to be able to be part of that growth with our value addition and ensuring that you really are able to appreciate good coffee in Nigeria.
Agriculture was once a major part of Nigeria's economy, but fell by the wayside as oil production began dominating the economy in the 1960s. President Muhammadu Buhari says he wants to build up the agriculture sector, although he has yet to appoint ministers to carry that out. Head of Operations Alfred Mwai says one of Quality Africa's goals is to work with farmers to improve the quality of Nigeria's beans.
Are you able to bring up practices that you really be able to process the coffee to a very, you know, quite clean level, which will of course go to the next level of specialty coffee?
In the meantime, the company hopes not just to win over customers, but to make good coffee a part of Nigerians' morning ritual. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the final days of August, the Nigerian-based terrorist group Boko Haram carried out a half dozen raids on villages in northeast Nigeria, reportedly killing more than 80 people. The United States strongly condemns these attacks. These raids are just another example of the horrific and indiscriminate violence that Boko Haram continues to use to terrorize civilians in northeastern Nigeria and the Lake Chad Basin region. Governor of Nigeria's Borno State, Kashim Shettima, confirmed the attacks. According to the Associated Press, he said, "I want us all to understand that the Boko Haram crisis is a calamity that has befallen us, as the insurgents do not discriminate whether somebody is Christian or Muslim. Neither do they have any tribal sympathy or affiliations." August 27th marked the 500th day since Boko Haram kidnapped 276 girls from their school in Chibok. The kidnapping galvanized international attention for the Boko Haram conflict. It is one of many attacks, kidnappings, raids, and other acts of indiscriminate violence that continue on a frequent basis in Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Cameroon. According to press reports, Boko Haram has killed more than 15,000 people since 2009. Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, recently visited Washington, where he and President Barack Obama discussed ongoing plans to defeat the terrorist group Boko Haram. President Obama expressed his support for President Buhari's very clear agenda in defeating Boko Haram extremists of all sorts inside his country. The U.S. contributes to these efforts through a number of security and counterterrorism assistance programs, which provide intelligence, advisors, training, equipment, and logistics. The United States also provides support to the multinational joint task force, which the Lake Chad Basin countries and Benin are standing up to coordinate the regional efforts to counter Boko Haram. The United States will continue to support the governments and people of the Lake Chad Basin region in their struggle to defeat Boko Haram.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.